Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report, The Federal Land Bank System, right after this. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Well, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. It's public business that is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper are things like stocks and bonds and Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, in 1965, our Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and clad coin or currency. And you know that's very true when we're dealing with the banks and government and commercial industry. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in purchasing power of that gold over paper. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper versus gold. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good reason. They knew, and they knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for you and I to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well when they did it back in 1933, that in order for them to subjugate a free people and impose the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto upon us, they would first have to take away our gold and silver coin to take away our property rights and to destroy those property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights, and that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me show you how to do just that. That's in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult homeschool. Now, if you'd like more information about our private business school, then call and order our free general law CD package first. And that's the place to start. Doesn't cost you anything. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's informative, it's educational, and it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org, and click onto the archives. Yeah, I picked up a book here the other day, and it's called Night Came to the Farms of the Great Plains. The author's name is Raymond D. North. It's put out by Acres, USA. In 1900, the agricultural system in the United States had proved itself to be so viable, so robust, that American agriculture had surpassed every other country in the world in productivity. We were the most productive, most prosperous, most profitable agricultural nation in the world. And we accomplished that in about 113 years. Between 1787 and 1900, 113 years, we became the world's dominant agricultural power. Now, in the period from 1900 to about 1960, we were the world's number one dominant power, but we began to falter. And beginning in the 1960s, American agriculture got on the slippery slope until today, we're no longer the world's number one agricultural power. No longer the most prosperous, no longer the envy of the world in our productivity. We have done something between 1900 and 2010 that has caused this effect. And the answer to that is called the Federal Land Bank, which was organized and created by Congress in 1916. And it's reported here in the book in Chapter 4. That's why I thought this week we'd talk about this Federal Land Bank, because the Federal Land Bank is also mentioned in the protocols, which were first published in 1884. Of course, it was a secret publication. It didn't come to light until 1909, and then it didn't get widespread distribution until Henry Ford published it in the Dearborn Gazette back in 1922. And I'll bring that to bear as we progress along. But there's a chapter in here that deals with the Federal Reserve, and it deals with Reaganomics. You've probably heard that term, Reaganomics. Reaganomics, I thought, was some kind of a political economic term, that it was a political theory of economics as opposed to the Keynes or the Keynesian economic theory. I was dead wrong. It isn't the first time, won't be the last. Reaganomics was a system which was designed to bankrupt the farmers of America and indeed deliver the American economic system into total bankruptcy and the New World Order. It wasn't benign and it wasn't accidental. It was a wicked and evil scheme, to be sure, but it's based upon genius. It is a genius, an evil and wicked genius, that has produced this world depression that we see ourselves embroiled in today. Now, the reason I use the word depression is because the numbers that we see are equal to the numbers that we saw and parallel the numbers that we saw from 1929 to 33. In that 3.5 years, the stock market declined 89%. Housing foreclosures, the number of unemployed, the price structure of the economy, and so on, there's an exact parallel. And I suspect that we can expect this parallel to continue because it works so perfectly for the powers that be from 29 to 33. They've simply adopted that same protocol, and they're doing the same thing today. So I think we'd be pretty safe in saying that in the end, about the year 2012 or 13, when this thing reaches the bottom, I think that the stock market will have lost 90%, the unemployment rate will top 25%, that we will be in depression probably after a hyperinflation, and so on. Although we didn't have a hyperinflation in the 1930s, we just had depression. I think we'll go through hyperinflation first. Now, that being the case, who were the geniuses that thought this up? Who figured this thing out and then put it into play and executed it so perfectly? We now have more people locked up in our prisons than we have on our farms producing our food. America, which was the world's number one agricultural producer from 1900 to 1960, is now a net importing country. We produce less food in this country than we consume. I know that that sounds shocking, especially for us old guys that can remember when America had so much in the way of agricultural surpluses we had to stack it in the streets and come up with farm programs to figure out what to do with it all. Well, those times have changed. Now, whether that's good politics or bad politics, or good policy or bad policy, or good economics or bad economics, you know, I'll leave it up to you to decide. I'm just going to give you the facts and figures and tell you where to get the story. And the story is revealed by a fellow named Charles Walters, who was the editor. He died just recently. I forgot now if he died at the beginning of this year or last year. It was in January, I remember, when he died, and it could have been 2009 now. Time goes, you know, when you get old. But Charles Walters publishes a paper, he did publish a paper called Acres USA, so you ought to jot this down. If you're not a subscriber, you should be, so that you can keep abreast of what's going on, because it's going to affect you. I don't care if you live in downtown Manhattan. It's going to affect you. In fact, it's going to affect you harder in downtown Manhattan, Los Angeles, and New York, and Miami than it's going to affect the Amish man in Seymour, Missouri. He's going to eat. You're not. So if you want to know where agriculture is headed here in America in this Great Depression that we're headed into, where in the 1930s you were forced to sell apples on the street corners, and boys and girls, you're not going to have any apples to sell on the street corners when this thing comes to fruition. Acres USA, their telephone number, 512-892-4400. That's a 512-892-4400. If you want to call toll-free, it's 1-800-355-5313. Now, that's in the United States and Canada. You Canadians up there, 1-800-355-5313. Online, they're called acresusa.com, www.acresusa.com. It's all one word. I think it's about $30 a year or thereabouts. Why don't you call them first or send them an email, get the prices, and find out. When they have to ship it overseas, you got to pay a couple of bucks more. So you guys up in Canada are going to have to pay them an extra couple bucks there, but it's well worth the money. And the book that we're going to review here is called Night Came to the Farms of the Great Plains. And the book you're looking for here, Night Came to the Farms of the Great Plains, Raymond D. North. So I'm going to begin with a little background. You Canadians up there are in on the program also, and that's because the Great Plains extend up into Canada. And this operation here called the Great Plains, it's one of the greatest agricultural pieces of real estate on planet Earth. I mean, it's got its drawbacks, it's got its droughts, and it's got its this, that, and another thing over here. But when you get right down to where the rubber meets the road, if you people in Africa or Asia or in Siberia, if you had a square mile of this kind of real estate, you'd put a fence around it and call it a national park. And this is pretty good real estate, and it's got pretty good dirt on it. And it has for many years produced an abundance of food. It's not doing that so much anymore, and there's some really international geopolitical reasons for it. We begin with the Great Plains is a relatively flat, treeless, dry, natural grassland, and it's located in Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, North and South Dakota. And it also extends well up into Canada. Now, saying that it is relatively flat does not mean that it lacks hills, but that it is about all it means. There are no mountains worthy of the name, and although the Ozarks Mountains of southern Missouri and northern Arkansas extend well into eastern Oklahoma and southeastern Kansas, there is also a chain of mountains in southern Arkansas and southeastern Oklahoma called the Wichita Mountains, the only mountain range in the western hemisphere that runs east and west. But these ranges are really rolling hills, and likewise east of Enid, Oklahoma, there is a small chain of hills known as the Glass Mountains, never more than a few hundred feet high and without any peaks. Now, the Black Hills of southwestern South Dakota are just what that name implies. Now, there are few trees as well. In western Kansas and Nebraska, it's possible to drive 10 miles or more and never see a single tree. Creeks and rivers that cross the Great Plains have trees along their banks. Oftentimes, they're elm trees or cottonwood trees. Many of the villages and towns have annual tree planting days, and then after a century of cultivation, they have created a fairly good tree cover. But the Great Plains will always be known as a place without trees. And during the early days of American history, travelers crossing the Great Plains always reported back east that this land could never be settled because of the lack of water and trees. It was considered a desert. The Great Plains weather is remarkably similar throughout the area. The summers are long, they're hot, they're dry. The temperatures well over 100 degrees in the day, Fahrenheit. They're common, and then they often persist for weeks on end. The winters are cold, and the northern winds are relentless. Amarillo, Texas has more wind than any city in the nation, including Chicago, Dodge City. Now, Dodge City, Kansas is second in windiness. Guymon, Oklahoma is third. This constant wind, whether coming from the north in winter or the south in summer, dries out the land, and it can be very monotonous to those of us who live here on the Great Plains. Temperatures below freezing may last for several months in the northern states. Winter storms in the southern states are mild by comparison. They consist of very sharp cold snap before it warms up again. Drought hits the area about every 25 years, and it creates tremendous social and financial dislocations. The 1850s were dry years in Kansas. Old John Brown lived through that drought, then went east and became the famous John Brown of Harper's Ferry fame. One can easily imagine how some of his wilder ideas were formed during that horrible drought of the 1850s. Now, the 1890s were also dry, so dry that many farmers gave up and left for the wetter parts of the nation. When Jacob Coxey marched on Washington to demand relief in 1894, part of his contingent, the famous Cox's Army, was recruited from the Great Plains. In South Dakota, Laura Ingalls Wilder and her husband Almanzo Wilder suffered greatly from this same drought and the constant crop failures that it caused. So the Wilders left in 1894, traveling by wagon to Mansfield, Missouri, where they established their new farm home. Laura Ingalls Wilder became a good storyteller, and during her next 40 years in the Ozarks, at the age of 65, she wrote the first of her memorable Little House on the Prairie books. Later, it became a popular television series. Her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, lived there for many years and developed into an artful storyteller as well. She commented that the valleys and flatlands raised good corn, whereas it took hills to raise good men. Well, this may be true, but she should have carried this thought one step further and noted that the Great Plains nurtured great women. Whenever the Great Plains suffered an economic collapse, such as the one that we're now in, we go back to the basics, back to our women, and they nurture us through it. Our women hold us together. They're the great insurance policy that we have out here on the Great Plains. During the Dust Bowl days of the 1930s, the rain failed for nearly 10 years. There was no recorded moisture at all in the panhandle town of Guymon, Oklahoma, during the entire year 1935. Its citizens in Guymon, Oklahoma, were too poor to pay their taxes, so school did not open that fall. In parts of Garfield County, Oklahoma, and up into the center of Kansas, there were only skiffs of snow in February of 1938, and then no moisture at all until November. Trees died along the creek banks, and wells dried up. Towns and cities had to ration water. A great exodus from the land emptied the countryside. The drought of the 1950s was not as severe as the previous two, but still many farmers gave up and left for the cities. Now, as I write, there is a great drought that has fastened itself upon parts of Nebraska and all of North and South Dakota. The latter state, North Dakota, has already endured over 3 years of drought, and when I visited Bismarck, North Dakota in the summer of 1989, a dust storm raged with such blinding intensity that it was impossible to drive safely on the highway. Kansas lost half of its wheat crop in 1989 to the drought in the western part of the state, and wheat production was sparse in the nearby Oklahoma and Texas panhandles. Cattle are an important facet of agriculture in all of the six states that comprise the classic Great Plains, as they account for a great deal of the farm and ranch income there. Wheat is the only cultivated crop of commercial significance in the Great Plains, and it's grown all over the territory from southern Texas to North Dakota and well into Canada because it is the principal cash crop of the Great Plains. The story about to unfold is essentially a story of wheat. Some areas are known for producing a certain commodity, and they derive much of their income from it. Cotton, for example, is grown in Texas and southern Oklahoma, but it's seldom seen north of there. Flax is a common crop in the Dakotas. It's a weed everywhere else. Soybeans are important in the three northern states, but something of an oddity everywhere else. Eastern Nebraska has plenty of corn, whereas Alfalfa County, Oklahoma, couldn't come up with a single acre of corn, even if all the sweet corn grown in every backyard garden was counted. Wheat was one of the earliest imports onto this continent after the first European settlements were founded. Native Americans already had corn, and they taught the white settlers how to grow it. Corn was on the table at the first Thanksgiving in 1621, but it wasn't long until the settlers demanded the fine bread that can only be made from wheat. George Washington grew wheat and milled it into flour and sold it throughout Virginia. Much of Washington's income came from such sales. Cotton didn't become a significant crop in the South until well after Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin in 1793. And Washington's soil yielded such poor tobacco due to its high acidity that wheat flour sales carried him through the Revolutionary War. It was a period during which the British weren't buying very much American tobacco anyway. The people who settled the Great Plains after the Civil War brought corn with them, but it didn't do well because corn pollen hardens at 96 degrees Fahrenheit. 96 is a common temperature over the Great Plains summer. And unless properly pollinated, a corn ear will not fill. Farmers call such a plant a nubbin because it has no grain. A group of immigrants from southern Russia settled in McPherson, Kansas during the early 1870s. They were Mennonites. Legend has it that the women Mennonites hid wheat in the seams of their underclothes to smuggle the wheat seed out of Russia. This wheat was called Turkey Red, and all winter wheat now grown in the United States is a descendant of this Mennonite Turkey Red wheat from Russia. Now, the Mennonites taught other pioneers to value wheat and to grow it correctly. Other Germans from the Volga Valley in Russia arrived in 1876, and in a few years, the seventh and greatest breadbasket on earth in all of world's history was launched and underway. Winter wheat is the principal cash crop of the lower three Great Plains states, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. The northern three Great Plains states also grow some winter wheat, although North and South Dakota mostly grow spring wheat. There's a small genetic difference that separates spring and winter wheat. Winter wheat is a chromosome short, and it must go through at least one hard freeze in order for the wheat stalk to develop. Otherwise, the wheat stalk doesn't develop and it remains grass. Now, this characteristic is true to some degree in all kinds of wheat, and that explains why wheat is never found in the tropics. Now, winter wheat is planted during September and October in the southern Great Plains. When it comes up, it makes good grazing. It makes forage for cattle. At about 10 to 14 degrees Fahrenheit, wheat freezes to the soil, and there's also at least one such freeze every winter. It comes up from the roots sometime between late February and late March, depending upon the weather, of course. Then after late May, when the crop in southern Texas matures, the harvest begins to move north out of Texas, across the panhandle of Oklahoma, and up into Nebraska, and up across the Great Plains to northern Kansas, arriving there in late June. Therefore, the long, hot, dry months of July and August do not affect winter wheat. Winter wheat is a hard grain that eventually makes good bread. Spring wheat, grown most often in Nebraska and the Dakotas, cannot stand very much freezing. Since the soil in these states is often frozen all winter long, the crop is planted in late spring. Harvest time arrives in August and September. It's softer than winter wheat. Spring wheat makes good flour for pastries and pasta. The Great Plains wheat industry is both a great national blessing and a grave national problem. Wheat production is abundant enough to satisfy all of our domestic needs, with a great deal left over for export. A considerable part of this country's earnings from foreign trade is generated by the sale of wheat in the international market. When government programs, imports, and market manipulation cause wheat to pile up in government warehouses, the inventory is used to feed the hungry populations of the third world countries. Famines in many parts of the world have been halted or averted with American wheat. Government planners can always rely upon a plentiful supply of wheat, an advantage only four other countries in the world possess. That's Canada, Australia, Argentina, and New Zealand. All other countries must constantly worry about their food supply. Japan and England, for example, have to import over one half of their food. Their nation's planners must constantly concern themselves with this shortage. People stand for hours in food lines in Russia and other communist countries just to get a loaf of bread. Have you ever seen a bread line in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand? Of course not. And the reason for this is the abundance of wheat. You will see soup lines in the United States and in the Great Plains, but that involves the soul of this nation, not the production of wheat. But wheat also appears to bring abundant trouble. So much wheat is grown, the authorities say, that the farmers cannot make money. Hunger, starvation, and malnourishment exist throughout much of the Great Plains, and food pantries everywhere are at work to help the poor, many of whom are wheat farmers. When crops are poor and prices low, wheat then is considered a curse on the farmer. Now, many remedies have been tried over the years to help the wheat farmer, and none have really worked very well. Probably the best were the parity and the every normal granary ideas of Henry A. Wallace, who served as Secretary of Agriculture from 1933 to 1940, and then as Vice President during Franklin Roosevelt's third term. Wallace's plans restricted the planting of wheat and thus lowered production. Any government plan or scheme that does not control the output of wheat is always doomed to early failure. It became the adage. Every subsequent generation of politician in America has failed to learn this simple lesson of history. But the people of the Great Plains have always known why profligate wheat production brings plentiful hardship. Kansas lost half of its 1989 wheat crop to drought, and the Oklahoma and Texas panhandles were severely damaged as well. Wheat production also fell sharply in the Dakotas, as many farms only grew 5 to 10 bushels to the acre. Plants that would have been 30 inches tall in a good year were only 6 inches high. The heads of the wheat were about half an inch long when they should have been 3 inches long, and combine sickles couldn't be set low enough to cut the grain. But despite all of this hardship, wheat supplies are still good, guaranteeing plenty of bread, pasta, and pastry for everybody. Bread in my local stores is selling at 99 cents for 3 large loaves. There's absolutely no excuse for hunger in America. Drive 100 miles in any direction from Enid, Oklahoma, and all there is in cultivation is wheat. In western Kansas, a 2,000-acre wheat field is very common. The Dakotas have even larger wheat fields. An ocean of wheat fills the horizon, and yet farmers cannot make a profit. This is the basic economic situation on the Great Plains. Misconduct by two government agents and agencies and a badly misjudged national farm policy adversely affected agriculture in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, and the 1980s, bringing darkness to the farms of the Great Plains. And this is the story of how that happens. Well, let me take my break here, boys and girls, and we'll whip over here and take a look at the title of the story this week called The Federal Land Banks, right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download the general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or the publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to endorse and recommend the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. We are reviewing the book called Night Came to the Farms of the Great Plains, What Has Happened to American Agriculture? Now, the book is written by Raymond Dean North, and it's put out by Acres USA. So if you want a copy, you buy it from Acres USA, call them at 1-800-355-5313 in the United States and Canada. I imagine you could call them anywhere in the world on that number, but it's toll-free in the United States and Canada, and when you call from China, South Korea, or Japan, you probably don't have to pay for it. But no matter the price, it'll be well worth it. Now, for a good understanding of how farm policy in the United States has bankrupted the American farmer, not just the wheat farmer, you wheat guys out there, relax. They got us all. They didn't just get you guys. And they got us with Reaganomics through the federal land bank system. Now, this federal land bank was set up in 1916 with the express purpose of helping the farmer. You see, if the powers that be, whose real agenda is to destroy you, to destroy agriculture in America, to bankrupt the American farmer, if they came to you and said, look, we are your worst enemies. We are your very worst nightmare. We are going to bury you. You people wouldn't sit still for that. Why, you'd run these clowns out of here. Now, there's not very many of these people that are attached to these secret societies. In fact, the entire conspiracy worldwide doesn't have more than 20 million adherents. And these 20 million people, with a dedicated agenda, have subjugated the entire world of 7 billion people. And they've done it in 100 years. I tell you, boys and girls, it's sheer genius. And we'll talk about that a little more as we progress along. But how did they do it? Well, they did it by befriending us. They come to us and say, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And then they propose a solution to our problem, a problem that these secret societies caused. And then they come in and they say, oh, my God, look at this problem. Here, we want to help. Let's propose a solution. And so we say, well, okay, let's give it a try. And the solution failed. And then they come back and they say, oh, my God, we really empathize with you. We want to help. We're from the government. Let's propose another farm program. So they do. And they've been doing this now for 100 years. They started in 1916. You know, it's right at 100 years, trying to solve the problem. And, you know, from time to time, we make money hand over fist, and we say, God bless those bureaucrats in Washington. And then when the next collapse comes, it's worse than the last one. And progressively, one collapse after another has progressed until here's the result. In 1920, there were about 50% of the American people living on the farms in a prosperous agricultural America, and the other 50% lived in the cities benefiting from that agricultural prosperity. Today, 97% of us live in the cities. Less than 3% of us live on the land. There's only 900,000 farmers left in America, and we have 2 million people locked up in prison. Boys and girls, we've got fewer farmers than we have prisoners. I said 900,000. It's actually 1,900,000. It's 100,000 less than the number of prisoners we have locked up in jail. So we've gone from about 45 to 50 million people living on the land. In 1950, we had 15 million farmers, and today we've got about 2 million, a little less. Something happened here, and what happened was bad for the farmer. It was bad for the average Joe Sixpack American. It was the greatest thing that ever happened to banks, insurance companies, and government. I mean, when we're talking about multinational corporations like Archer Daniels, Midland, and Cargill, and Pillsbury, and General Mills, and so on, I mean, this has been a windfall of profits on top of profits on top of profits. I mean, these people have made money like you can't believe off the backs of us farmers out here, while we are bankrupt. They are smoking cigars. So let's take a look at where this thing begins. It's called the Land Bank System, and it's Chapter 4. Listen to this story. By 1916, it was already clear that the Federal Reserve System was not working in the Farm Belt. So Congress passed the Federal Farm Loan Act, and it established 12 federal land banks and designated their locations. The Great Plains Land Banks are currently located in St. Paul, Omaha, Wichita, and Austin, Texas. That's Wichita, Kansas, Omaha, Nebraska, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Austin, Texas. These four banks did great injury to the farmers of the Great Plains, and they will be reviewed in detail. The federal land bank districts do not coincide with the Federal Reserve Bank districts. No valid reason exists for this discrepancy. For example, while North and South Dakota belong to the Federal Reserve Bank District headquartered at Minneapolis, the Federal Land Bank splits them up. North Dakota belongs to the district administered out of St. Paul, but South Dakota belongs to the Omaha office. Because the Dakotas possess identical economies, separating them makes no sense at all economically. The Federal Land Bank for Missouri is located at St. Louis, Missouri, whereas the Kansas Bank is in Wichita, Kansas, 100 miles or so down the road from the Federal Reserve Bank in Kansas City. Confused? Hold on. Much of Oklahoma is under the jurisdiction of the Federal Land Bank at Wichita, Kansas, but the Federal Reserve Bank district runs out of Dallas, Texas, which includes southeastern Oklahoma. Now, taken as a whole, the overlapping districts make this system a very confusing one. When you have a farm credit problem, you need to be an East Coast economic geographer to figure out where to get help. For a lawyer, it is obviously important to know the law, but it is crucial that he knows where to get help for his client. And a lawyer often is little more than a person who gets a client into the right government office where a decision can be made. Now, regrettably, the land banks are not identical to the Fed in generating consistent farm statistics either. Hence, they are of little value to policy planners in Washington, D.C. Neither the government nor the private sector is capable of rationally addressing the problem of running things from east to west, even though this structural misconception has plagued the country for more than 150 years. Now, during the Civil War, President Lincoln was amazed and distressed to find that the railroad system ran east and west, forcing Union troops to move south on foot. If history is inevitable, this may be one of the reasons. In the early days, the land banks reported annually to the U.S. Treasury, which they also depended upon for cash. They had nothing to do with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and their employees were protected by civil service guidelines and received government pensions upon retirement. Then, in 1935, an obscure senator from Missouri named Harry S. Truman introduced a bill to amend the Federal Farm Loan Act so the land banks would be administered by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Well, the bill was referred to the Committee on Banking and Currency, where it died. The land banks remained a part of Treasury, overseen by the same committee that killed Truman's bill. 4 years later, Franklin Roosevelt finished what Truman had started by transferring the land banks to the USDA. It was called the Reorganization Act of 1939, vested him with the power to make the transfer. His stated reason for doing this was that he wanted the farmer to have one location where he could receive all of the information concerning farm activities, subsidy programs, and government finance. The farmer should not have to drive all over town to do this, he said. Now, however laudable Roosevelt's intention, the transfer was a terrible mistake, and Henry Wallace publicly maintained that he was not informed about it in advance, and announced that the USDA wouldn't try to control the day-to-day affairs of the land banks. Yet, the transfer did not adversely affect the farmers of the Great Plains until 1971. It was in 1971 when Congress passed that year's version of the Farm Credit Act. This bill visited financial agony on the wheat farmers of the Great Plains, and it is one of the principal causes of the economic collapse that hit the region like a thunderclap in 1981. And ever since the land banks were created in 1916, concerned parties have argued over whether the land banks are private or public in nature, whether they fall under federal or state law. And according to the original enabling legislation, the land banks were supposed to raise their own money. This makes them look private to many observers. However, Congress appropriated money to start these land banks, and of the original $9 million used to capitalize the banks came from congressional appropriation. This gives them a definite federal tinge. Also, the land banks were placed under the Department of Treasury, where they were governed by the Farm Loan Board, and the President of the United States obviously has no transfer power over private business. Well, since Congress twice had to appropriate additional money to the land banks, once in 1933 to help them through the Great Depression, then again in 1984 to guarantee certain bonds the banks had issued, these actions tend to bolster the federal agency argument. On the other hand, the startup and the Great Depression appropriations were repaid. Nothing has been repaid on the 1984 appropriations, nor on others made since then. Now, the land banks generated all other monies from their own operations. More important still, in terms of amounts, are the sums the system has borrowed from private money markets. In 1954, for instance, the Eisenhower administration unleashed the banks. This meant that they were farm cooperatives and nothing would be done to try to regulate them. In 1958, their employees were removed from the civil service protection as to political hirings and firings, and they were removed from the pension rolls of the government. Making the farm credit system an independent agency of the government was an idea that sounded good, and that was politically popular. Now here, the activities of Secretary of Agriculture Ezra Taft Benson were scarcely altruistic because he had been executive secretary of the National Council of Farmers Cooperatives, and he was just favoring his former employer by increasing the farm co-op movement. Now, if an agency of government is truly independent, then it can truly be responsible to no one. And that's what happened during the Nixon administration when the Farm Credit System decided to socialize the long-term credit system of farmers. There has never been public discussion on this. And the biggest failure of an independent agency of government is the fact that they became doctrinaire and wholly unpredictable. This would make the banks appear to be private banks. Their bonds are not required to be listed with the Securities and Exchange Commission since they're a federal agency. State security commissions have uniformly refused to require listings because of the federal nature. In other words, speaking biologically, not financially, these banks are mules. That's the way one of its loan officers explained it to me. What, may we ask, is a mule? Well, a mule is a hybrid caused by breeding a female horse to a male ass. When I review the activities of these banks in the various county courthouses across the Great Plains, I see that this is correct. And additionally, actually, there has always been a point of legal contention on this, but it did not become material until 1981, at which point the farm economy started its final collapse. Now, the reason for this is the fact that these banks were well run and lawsuits did not develop. After 1981, a multiplicity of lawsuits developed, and lawyers everywhere started to question the legal status of these banks. Now, let me pause right here, and let's take a look from what we've seen so far, and at the credentials of the author. The author here is a certified public accountant, and it's good for us that he is a CPA, because we're dealing here with numbers. And while it's true that numbers don't lie, liars can use numbers. Now, when these people come to us from the Federal Land Bank and they say, we're from the government, we're here to help. Or, you know, if Congress says, listen, we need a farm bill to protect and to help the little farmer, we believe what they tell us. Hey, they're trying. When somebody comes up and asks you for directions, do you deliberately give the man false directions so that he will become lost or more lost? Or do you give him directions as best you can? Well, listen, what has happened here in America, our government has deliberately given us false directions. That's what's caused the collapse of the economy. These people aren't our friends. These people are our enemies. But we believe that they're our friends. I mean, after all, they say that they're our friends. They say they're trying to help us. They say, here, let's pass this bill for you. And then sometimes it's 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years later that we get to the outcome, and by that time the people that they made the promises to are long dead, and those of us that are standing around saying, well, they were doing the best they could, and we're just sorry as hell it didn't work. Listen to this story, because it deals with land banks. This is the sixth protocol, and it says, at the same time, it will be necessary to encourage trade and industry vigorously, and especially speculation, the function of which is to act as a counterpoise to industry. Without speculation, industry will cause private capital to increase and tend to improve the condition of agriculture by freeing the land from indebtedness for loans by the land banks. It is necessary for industry to deplete the land both of laborers and capital, and through speculation, transfer all of the money of the world into our hands, thereby throwing the Gentiles into the ranks of the proletariat. The Gentiles will then bow before us to obtain the right to existence. Now, I underlined the word land banks because the history of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion works something like this. In 1922, Henry Ford Sr. of the famous Ford Motor Company, when he picked up on this, he published this in his newspaper in Dearborn, Michigan. He also wrote a book called The International Jew. Where did Henry Ford get his information? He got it from a Russian countess who smuggled the protocols out of Russia to Paris, France in 1909. Well, where did the Russian countess get it? She got it from the insiders in Russia who were a part of the conspiracy in Zurich, Switzerland in 1884 when these protocols were first written. That's the history of it. I want you to notice the word land banks. Because in 1884, boys and girls, there weren't any land banks. The land banks didn't come into existence in this country until 1916. No, boys and girls, the collapse of the farm economy isn't an accident. It isn't something that's done by ignorant people who mean well. The collapse of the farm economy is a part of an agenda. It's a part of a well-thought-out master plan to bankrupt the nation, to bankrupt its farmers, put it into chaos, and blend it or meld it into a new world order. This isn't ignorance. This is genius. It may be wicked. It may be evil. It may be counter to our best interests. This isn't something that the average Joe Sixpack can think up. Furthermore, this isn't even something that the average Joe Sixpack can even understand. The average farmer, when you tell him this story, goes right over his head. And he says, well, you got to be anti-Semitic. You got to be a racist, you know. based upon his education, based upon his public school, based upon his politics, his religion, his economics, everything that he knows, everything he's learned all of his life. Why, this is just rank un-American, anti-Semitic, and hate-mongering, and so on. I don't think so. I don't think so. Now, I'm a reporter, and my job is to go out here and dig out these kind of stories. And when I saw this story put out by Acres USA, it triggered in my brain, you know, as I said, wait a minute, land bank? I can remember something in the protocols about land banks. Well, let's just look at this. It says, we want to cause private capital to increase and tend to improve the condition of agriculture by freeing the land bank from indebtedness for loans by the land banks. It is necessary for industry to deplete the land, both of laborers and capital. Boys and girls, that isn't something that I'm warning you about today and saying if you don't vote for Harry over Bob in the upcoming election, why, these people are going to deplete the land of its laborers. Boys and girls, this is already accomplished fact. This is a done deal. Boys and girls, 15 million farmers, 15 million little guys out here producing your food and fiber have now been driven off the farms since 1950 and into the cities. You're down to 1,900,000 left. This is already an accomplished fact. It's already a done deal. It doesn't really make any difference at this moment in time whether this is being done by a secret society called the Learned Elders of Zion or whether it's being done by the Republicans and Democrats, which, by the way, it's being done by all three. It's Republicans, Democrats, and the Learned Elders of Zion, coupled with the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Bilderbergers, all connected together. These guys are working against you. I just wanted to point out to you that it was the Learned Elders that spelled it out and confessed to it, and we wouldn't have known about it if they hadn't written this in 1884. All right, I'm out of time, so I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desks, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log, schedule, and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.